and let the recorder know that this is an interview with Robert Robson taking place on November the 17th, 2005. So Mr. Robson, I thought we could begin, as I mentioned, with a discussion of your early life, and maybe we could start at the very beginning, and I could ask you...
when I was born, huh?
When you were born and where?
I was born in North Dakota and raised in South Dakota.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in South Dakota?
Well, I was a kind of a pheasant hunter and a duck hunter, you know. Fisherman.
A lot of outdoor activities in your youth?
Well, I played football, basketball, that sort of stuff.
Uh-huh. And what was the community like where you grew up?
The community I grew up in was Brookings, South Dakota, and it was one of the world's great places. In fact, I was back at my 50th high school reunion back there a few years ago, and it's still as pretty a place as it always was.
And could you tell me a little bit about your family, how your father and mother spent their days?
My father was a railway postman.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was a homekeeper, and she drove a mail route.
All right. So was it a farming community primarily, or?
Eastern part of South Dakota is all farms. The town I grew up in was a college town, South Dakota State University in Brookings, and we lived on the outside of town, and it was kind of a farming town, you know.
Right.
Main business was farming.
And did you go to the public schools all the way through high school there?
Public schools. I went to the college there, yeah.
Okay. And what, you mentioned playing a lot of sports during high school. What was...
Yeah, we had one of the world's great, in fact, I was, you get here, I'll show you, we had one of the world's great football and basketball teams.
And what position did you play on the football team?
I played a linebacker and end.
All right, so you must be a big guy. in terms of what was happening in the classroom during high school, what sort of subjects interested you the most?
Oh, I don't know.
Did you?
Went to college. I ended up going in industrial engineering, but I don't know. I'm on the city council now, and I am really bad-mouthing these schools here because they don't teach English in reading, writing, and arithmetic, you know?
Right.
So I guess I concentrated on reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Well, how do you account for your interest in industrial engineering when you went to college? Were you interested in mechanical things, radios, cars as a young man?
Well, when I missed a semester in or quarter in college, and then I got drafted. In fact, my dad was on the draft board, and I think he got me drafted. And then because I got halfway decent grades on whatever they take you, put you through, I ended up in electronics.
While you were in
the Army.
Okay.
And that kind of, I'd already had a couple of years of college, but that electronics business
Right.
And these things were big messes, you know. They never operated very long, and that's kind of how I kind of got into the, you know, the electronics business.
Right. Was that primarily for radio communications while you were in the service?
We had a couple of television sets in our, or a couple of radar sets in our division, but over in Germany, but it was mainly all the communications was done by tube sets, radio sets, you know.
Right. So, so for how long were you in the service?
I was in for, you know, and it was, I like to look back on it as being the most miserable time of my life. I was in for 21 months, but boy, the more I get older, the better I like it, you know, because I went all over the world, you know.
You were in Germany?
21 months, so.
Right. And when you came back, you resumed your studies at...
I resumed my studies, and then I moved out to California in 1957. My girlfriend, who lived in a town called Pierre, South Dakota,
mm-hmm.
she moved out here with her parents, and I kind of followed her out, and we got married that summer in 1957. Out in Palo Alto.
Was her family moving out to Palo Alto or to the Bay Area for a...
Her mother had just gotten a divorce, and she had a lot of money, and so she bought a motel called the Paso del Norte Motel in Palo Alto, right across the street from, what the heck's the name of that big hotel there? So I stayed there in Palo Alto. I came out with a friend of mine, and we stayed at the motel there.
Was that right after you graduated?
I can't remember the name of the hotel. It was right across. Ricky's was the name of it.
Oh, okay.
I'm still there even.
I know exactly where that is.
Yeah, well, that's where we had our, we got married in the Presbyterian Church there in Palo Alto, and then had a reception at Ricky's.
Oh, all right.
In 1957.
And
by then I was living in the motel across the street, and my girlfriend, my wife, was living with her mother there in the motel, and I had to get the mother kept saying, hey, you gotta get a job, you know, so I went to work at a place called Farnsworth Electronics. It's right across the street from the original Fairchild.
And was that, what sort of an outfit was Farnsworth?
Farnsworth actually was a very famous engineer in the Second World War. A really a sharp guy. And we were making, my job as a foreman there was making selenium rectifiers.
Okay.
So I got into the semiconductor business in 1957.
And you were overseeing a production line for these rectifiers?
I had a whole production line. I had about 40 girls working on there, making, stacking up these little selenium cells. And most of the stuff got sold to the government.
Right. And, with being newly married and getting this, this new job.
Having all these girls working for me, yeah.
Yeah. did you find, what was your life like outside of work? Did you get into outdoor activities in the Bay Area when you got settled?
A little bit. you never had much time, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, we'd go down deer hunting down around south of Gilroy and go duck hunting up here in the area over here and go fishing out in the bay.
Right.
You know, but most these days we're pretty, you know, newly married and working pretty hard, you know.
I'm sure.
Not making a hell of a lot of money either.
Well, I guess Fairchild was just getting started about the time you...
Fairchild was right across the street.
Okay.
Wiseman Road, yeah.
And so, when did you make the move across the street to work with them?
What happened is the Selenium Rectifier, the Farnsworth thing, and they were bought out by AT&T, or AT&T.
Right.
AT&T, I think.
Uh-huh.
And they moved the production operation down to Puerto Rico.
I see.
And so another guy that ran the night shift, I said, look, I'm going to go across the street and get another job over here at Fairchild, and you take my job. And so that's what happened, you know. And I just walked, just right across the street, you know.
Right.
And so I went over there, and I was hired by Gene Kleiner.
Okay. And was at that time he was really, I guess they must have been gearing up for production, or were they already?
No, this was a complete pre-production operation. They didn't, in fact, I was hired as a foreman.
Right.
And I actually personally assembled the first silicon transistors they made.
Okay.
They had just started.
So it was in 57 that you walked across the street?
Yeah.
Okay.
57 or early 58.
Okay. And so who were you working directly with to get that assembly operation?
I worked with a guy by the name of Dick Parker.
Uh-huh.
John Carnahan was another one of the foremen. And my main boss was John Ernie, because I was running the diffusion and masking and all that stuff, you know.
Okay. Which he said.
And then I had my own little assembly line where we assembled the stuff that we made, you know.
And could you describe the manufacturing operation, the facilities in those earliest days? How many people you had, what the physical plant was like?
it was a, I guess it was probably about a 8,000-foot building.
Uh-huh.
And where Gordon worked was up, they had offices up above with the big glass stuff looking out over the production area.
I see.
It was kind of divided into the diffusion and masking and then into the production and testing area.
Okay. All in one...
I don't even know if the building's still there or not, but...
I think it is.
It might be.
But the whole production operation and into assembly and test was all in that
all
one
there,
big space?
All there. I had another guy I was working with, and that was Harry Sello.
Uh-huh.
Ever heard of him?
Yep, I've interviewed Harry.
Yeah. Harry was basically in charge of pre-production. And that's what we were, pre-production.
Uh-huh.
Kind of, I work for Harry too, you know, Harry and John Ernie.
So so the operation, when you say that you were really doing pre-production, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
It means we didn't have anything to sell. And we didn't have anything to sell for several months until we made these first transistors.
Right.
transistors for about $60 a piece to the government.
Right.
Government agencies, you know, defense people.
Sure. So it was really in the early months getting.
Yeah, as far as I know, there were no transistors, silicon transistors, that had ever been built that were ever used for anything. And remember, these transistors are the things that took the place of the old tubes that I used to try. So I spent all my time throwing tubes out in the Army, you know.
Right. And could you tell me a little bit what it was like, or your recollections of what it was like working with Jean Arnie and Harry Cello in this pre-production phase? Was there a lot of pressure? What were they like to work with?
Well, you know, it was a lot of it just was a lot of long hours, and we didn't know what we were doing, you know. You know, I was working with Gordon and Bob Noyce and all these guys. You know, they were all there every day.
Out there on the.
Hey, West and Vic Greenwich and all these guys. You know, we didn't know what the hell we were doing exactly. I guess Bob Noyce was probably the smart one. You know.
And about how many people were in the overall?
I was employee number 64.
Okay.
And probably a year from then, when I went to work there, probably a year from then, I probably had about 40 people working for me, and that was probably half the place.
Right. So your role was really quickly became sort of the general foreman for the silicon transistor production line. Is that
I
right?
Was, and I had the assembly line, but I also had the diffusion and masking.
Right.
I remember going to work down there with, and Bob Noyce had come in at night. I mean, we worked terribly long hours, and Bob Noyce had come in and tell us how to do the masking, because he was a real genius at that stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He was a true genius.
Was he, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about that he was also a very charismatic guy. Was that your experience also?
Absolutely. He, in fact, my wife and I remember going up with him on the weekends. He had a cabin up in Tahoe, and we'd go up skiing, you know.
Right.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
How would you describe some of the other people that you mentioned? What were your early impressions of Gordon, for example?
Gordon was, let me see, how do I say it? Gordon was, he was in charge of research.
Right.
So, in order to do anything, we have to go to talk to Gordon about it, you know. He was just a hell of a lot of fun to be with, I know. And smarter than hell. And, you know, here you're talking chemistry. His job was the chemistry. Noyce's job was the physics, you know?
Right.
And those two don't, I mean, I guess they come together, but they come together not where I am. I don't know anything about it, you know, so. But.
When you say he was, Gordon was a lot of fun to be around in those days. Could you expand on that?
We were about the same age.
Right.
And, yeah, we'd go out, and right down the street was a bar called Roop's, and we used to, at night, we'd go down and have a beer, you know.
Right.
Yeah, he was a lot of fun. But Gordon was always a little more reserved than the rest of the guys.
Uh-huh. What was, Jean Arnie, was he more outgoing? Or what was he like in those days?
Oh, man, he was one of my favorite guys. He was another true genius guy. And he
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he was a hot-headed Swiss. I just thought the hell, I thought he was great. I went to work after 4 years at Fairchild. I went to work, him and I moved over to a place called Teledyne, Amelco.
With Jay Last.
Maybe Jay was involved, but I don't remember. But John and I went over there.
Okay.
And then we went to, after 4 years there, we went to another place called Intercell, which was bought out by GE.
Right.
Oh, hell, I worked with John Ernie for many, many years. He was a great guy.
Just personally and professionally, just... Is there anything?
Professionally, he was another physicist, you know.
He was what?
Another physicist, like Bob Noyce.
Right.
So, and he knew diffusion. He knew how long you leave a wafer in the oven until it gets down to 40 angstroms and that sort of thing. And he was truly a genius. John Ernie was.
Right.
He's gone now, I think, but...
Yes, he is.
I know he is.
But
I really enjoyed him, and we'd go out and have a beer at night, and he was... And I'm not saying a playboy, but he did have a few problems with his wife, you know. So, it's sort of Bob Noyce, you know.
Right.
But, Gordon never did.
So if I could just take you back into the those early days of Fairchild before you guys had product to sell, were you getting a lot of guidance in that that early production phase from Ernie about you know how the operators should do the diffusions and troubleshooting issues?
Ran the diffusion.
Okay.
And he ran it with an iron, kind of an iron hand. And we'd get together in the morning and say, okay, we're going to run these wafers for so long, and here's what's going to happen. He'd have a big blackboard there, and he's going to tell us, you know. He was a lot of fun to work with, John Ernie was. And, of course, Sheldon Roberts was making the wafers for us, you know.
Was he making the wafers there in the plant?
We were growing the crystals. We had a, and that was part of my operation too. I had a girl working there where we would take this, made these machines, and Gene Troyer was actually making the machines, and he'd take this thing, heat it up, fill it full of silicon, and heat it up, and then. Drop this little seed deal down into it. It was really kind of fascinating.
Did you have a machine shop to make those crystal pullers?
Yeah, we had a machine shop run by Gene Troyer.
Okay. And so he was making the actual pullers, huh?
He made the crystal pullers, yeah.
Right. Were you...
And he made all the assembly equipment, all the jigs for the masking and all that stuff.
Right. Was, what was Sheldon Roberts doing? Was he involved with
Sheldon was in charge of the crystal operation.
I see.
That's where you take the silicon, you buy a bunch of lumps of silicon and heat it up and then pull a crystal out of it and then you slice it up, you know?
Right.
Into wafers. And, Sheldon was in charge of that operation.
I see. And,
He was a sharp guy, too.
And was Gene Kleiner just taking an overall view with
that? Gene Kleiner was primarily in charge of kind of the administration thing.
I see. Gotcha.
He was a nice guy. I liked him, but he hired me.
Now, did Charlie Spork arrive before you departed?
Yeah. Now, what happened is the place on Wiseman Road there, they built a big old place over on Bayshore.
Uh-huh.
And I was doing all the wafer process. I stayed at the Wiseman Road for a while and did all the wafer processing. And then I'd take all these wafers over and give them to these guys in this great big building.
Okay.
And they would cut them up and make them into transistors and sell them to the government, you know.
I see.
And I didn't move over there for about a year. But the new place.
Right.
And when I moved over there, Charlie and I shared an office. I was then working for Frank Grady. Ever heard that name?
No, I haven't.
Oh, he was another nice guy. And Frank Grady was Charlie's boss and my boss.
Okay.
He worked for Bob Noyce.
Okay.
He was the manufacturing manager.
Okay.
And Charlie was working for him, and I was working because I was over in the other building. I was working for him.
I see.
Too. So I'd take all the wafers and bring them over, and then these guys would assemble at PASA and Bill Stansberry, and all these guys would assemble them over there. Mainly a big assembly operation.
I see. And did eventually the processing move over there?
All the processing moved over during that period. Because, I mean, this was getting to be pretty big business, you know?
Sure. Did some of the problems that you faced in your direct area of responsibility, did that start to change as it became, as just the demand grew, and then I guess the manufacturing had to grow to meet that?
Well, you know, you do these wafers, and in those days they were about half an inch in diameter, and you only get about 40 transistors on each one, and sometimes you wouldn't get any on a whole lot, you know.
Right.
Something was wrong, you know. What's your question?
I was just wondering if the sort of problems you were facing in your work began to change as it went from sort of a low volume to very quickly to a high volume of production. If you encountered different kinds of problems.
No, I think it was a big problem. I just don't think people know how to cope with it, you know. You get an order for 10,000 things from the Navy, and you know you're going to have to make, you know, it was a research operation, went to a pre-production operation, and went to a massive volume operation in a short period of time.
Right.
So, yeah, there were all kinds of them. I'm not saying problems, but, you know, I guess we coped with them as best we could.
Well, one story that I've heard about you from a couple people, from Harry Sello and from Gordon Moore, is this was this problem with the tap test and these bad transistors. Could you talk a little bit about that?
What test?
The tap test, I guess, tapping on the cans to figuring out why some of these transistors were failing.
Oh, well, yeah, we had a big problem. The stuff we were using to put these transistors in, these headers and things, they weren't clean. There was metal floating around. And if I tell you, one of these transistors, what a little piece of metal from the can falls in there or something, man, it ends up destroying your transistor, you know?
Right. And that was something that you kind of figured out with that it was this, you know.
I don't remember much of
Oh, okay.
I don't remember about it.
Okay. Let's see. When was it that... So, was it Imelco that you went to after...
Yeah, it was Imelco. John Ernie and I went to Imelco.
Uh-huh.
I guess this was probably 1961 or 62 or something. Him and I, he wanted me with him, and we went over there. We were hired by two great guys. One was George Kosmetsky, and I just met George. He was over in Hawaii with Gordon not a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And the other one was Henry Singleton.
Oh, right.
The company later became Teledyne.
Right.
One of the big companies in the world, you know?
Sure. So you were hired directly by those two?
I was hired by... John Ernie was running the Imelco operation. I was hired by George and Henry.
Right.
To be the manufacturing manager.
And that facility, the Imelco facility, was that in Mountain View?
Yeah, it was right over there, not far from the... actually, we would go to the same bar as the old Roof's bar, you know? Yeah, it was right in the same area. It was a big operation. I remember we were making, at one time, we were making something like 15,000 helicopter navigation and fire control computers a month, and that's when the Vietnamese were shooting down about half of them, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was a nasty deal, but we were making these computers for, we were making the transistors and microcircuits go into them.
Right. Now, was Imelco, they were making both transistors and got into integrated circuits while you were there?
The integrated circuit business came about the same time.
Okay.
You know, integrated circuits just more than one transistor on a thing, you know.
Sure. So you were manufacturing manager there at Imelco. What did that mean to be manufacturing manager? What sorts of issues did you...
I had about 300 people working for me.
Okay, yeah. That's one thing.
Yeah.
And so you were responsible at the end for all aspects of the manufacturing, from processing the wafers through test and assembly?
Yeah, and John Ernie was in charge of research then.
Okay. We're research.
It was me and him and basically George Kosmetsky, I guess. You know.
And I guess I forgot to ask you about on the sales side back at Fairchild. Was it Tom Bay who was the head?
Yeah, Tom Bay. Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about him?
Oh, he was a great guy, too. And being a salesman, he was kind of a party guy, you know?
Sure.
And him and Don Rogers.
Were the two
main... Don Rogers?
Yeah, Harry Cello had some good stories about him.
Well, I've got tons of them, yeah. But Tom Bay that was at Fairchild.
Right. Who was handling...
I got together later. I actually hired him one time later, you know. So.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
In what context?
Well, he... years later, I set up a company... hired him to be the sales kind of guy, you know.
Was that Microma?
I think it was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hadn't realized that connection.
Yeah, Tom Bay was in charge of sales there.
I see.
For a while.
Well, when going back then to Imelco, you're heading up manufacturing. Jean is doing
research.
Who was handling sales and marketing for you?
Oh, God, I don't know. I forget who was doing it then.
Okay. So you say that... So both you and Jean Arnie were at Imelco for 4 years or so?
I think about 4 years.
Uh-huh. What was...
In about 64 or so, yeah.
To where did, what was your next move after that?
Well, what, John and I both left and we went to, a place called Intercell. I mean, Teledyne ended up being a great big operation and kind of a big pain in the ass operation. And John and I both went to this place called Intercell to make a different type of transistor. And here again, he was in charge of research, and I was in charge of production.
Where was who had started up Intercell? Had it been going for some time, or
no? It was a brand new company.
Okay.
It was over in Cupertino.
Okay. And what were so you felt that the Teledyne Imelco was becoming a big
mess? I don't know
mess,
why I ever left Teledyne Imelco or Fairchild, but. There was probably reasons, you know, probably money or something, you know.
Right. So at what was Intercell? What were they trying to do technologically? That was
make a new type of transistor, transistor that used a little different technique. You know, John came up with it.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Worked like a champ. And it didn't take long to get into big production there either, you know.
And so during this time, did you maintain your friendship with
Gordon?
Yeah, and the other folks from Fairchild when you...
Yeah, actually, got along fine with them, and you know, he lived right in that area there, and so I'd occasionally see him, and we had a good time together, Julie Blank and Vic Wrench and Jay Last.
Was it mainly getting together for a beer, or were you guys doing hiking or
beer? We'd see each other at parties, you know.
Right. I guess with the amount of work that these operations were taking, you weren't having too much time to go fishing.
No, we didn't do much fishing at all. occasionally I'd go down to Mexico and go fishing or something, but, no, we, or, you know, in the Sierras or something.
Right.
But no, we didn't have any fishing time at all.
I think you said earlier that you were you manufacturing manager then again at Intercell?
I was vice president of manufacturing.
Okay. And then you say quickly had a very large operation working for you.
Yeah, it was in Cupertino.
Okay. And,
I think Cupertino, yeah.
So, and you were with Intercell for about another 4 years then, up until...
It was probably another 2.5-3 years.
2.5-3 years. So, what was your next move after that?
Well, after that, a couple of the guys there at Intercell and I, we set up a thing to make timing circuits, watch circuits.
Yeah.
And we set up a little company for doing that. That was called Microma.
Okay. I think that, if I'm not mistaken, that was a very early company in the digital watch business. Is that right?
Yeah. In fact, I have some digital watches on the wall here. I wanted to show you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't wait to see them.
Yeah. They were the first ones, yeah.
So could you tell me a little bit about this? So was it this sort of a spinoff then of Intercell for...
Yeah, it was, and we were just concentrating on watch circuits, and what happened basically was we were making these timing circuits. We were selling some to Bulova Watch Company and Gruen and Seiko and places like that, but these guys, these watch companies kind of put the muscle on you, and so we got... We hired a Czechoslovakian guy and made our own liquid crystals and started making our own watches, and that was kind of fun, you know?
Yeah. Where was it? Yeah, where was it, and
how... I guess it was down in Cupertino, too.
Uh-huh. And you got both into the watch circuits and also the liquid crystal display manufacturer there?
Yeah.
I see.
And that's where I got back together with Bob Noyce and Gordon and Andy Grove and that bunch again.
Because that must have been pretty early on into the history of Intel.
They were around a couple, 3 years before that, and then we got together, and it was my voice would come down every day and stop the plant. Andy'd come around, and Gordon would come around all the time.
Could you tell me a little bit about, did you sell the operation then to Intel?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. And then did you stay on as...
I stayed on about 6 months and then got the hell out.
Why is that?
Well, I don't know. After 18 years in the electronic business, there are other things to do besides work your tail off, you know?
Well, I had a couple questions about the deal with Intel. Was there a sense in which there was similar technology in terms of the processing of the watch circuits?
We had a technology that they didn't have.
Okay.
Now, they probably would never admit that, but our technology was low current stuff. We had some really good stuff, and they mainly got into the business to take that technology, you know.
This is a sort of a CMOS process? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Did you negotiate that deal with both Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore? Or?
Yeah, both of them at the same place. Yep.
Gotcha.
Yep.
So
they were both there. It was kind of a fun deal. A lot of nerve wracking, you know. But you know, Gordon and I were, and Bob also, we were neighbors, you know, also in Los Altos Hills.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, in fact, with the 5-iron, I could Martin lived just below me, and I could have hit his house with a 5-iron at any time. I saw him on the road every day almost.
Right. Huh.
So we were real close to the neighbors, and Bob Noyce was just up the hill from me.
So, it's funny for, it's such a high density of people in that industry at that time. It's pretty amazing. You know, everybody really...
Everyone lived around there, you know?
Yeah.
Bob made the deal.
Okay.
Bob made the deal, and him and I kind of had an agreement that, I was not going to stay there, kind of, okay?
Uh-huh. Was that just you letting him know that you weren't interested, or?
Him letting me know and me letting him know that I just wasn't going to stay around.
Okay.
It was a mutual agreement.
I see.
Gordon wasn't involved in that, but it was me and Bob, mainly.
Was it Gordon who was really interested in the technology that they would gain by the deal?
I don't know. I really can't answer that. I don't know.
Okay. You were mentioning that that Gordon and Bob Noyce and Andy Grove would stop by the operation quite often.
That's kind of the way down to Fairchild, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Or to Intel, yeah.
So, could you tell me a little bit about your impressions of Andy Grove in those days?
Andy's a terribly talented guy, I like him, but he's a no-nonsense guy.
Right.
But it was kind of understood that I wasn't going to be around there for too long. I was there probably 4 or 5 months,
I see. And then what did you do when you left Microma?
When I left, I took some money and bought this farm where I live now.
Okay. And what kind of I think somebody told me that it's a nut growing operation.
Yeah,
is that
pistachios,
right?
Almonds, stuff like that.
Now,
if you'd have come down here, I had a box of stuff for you to take back with you.
Oh man, well that's another incentive indeed. Had you been interested in doing that sort of work before, or? Where did that come from?
I was lived on the outside of a farm town when I was a kid, but not really. I just kind of, I had made some of the, it was time for me to get out of it, the electronic stuff.
Right. So did you set up the farm on your own, or was it an existing?
No, I set it up all on my own.
Wow. And have you been working it since that time?
Yeah. And about that time is when Gordon and I started fishing.
This would be in the mid-70s or so?
Early 70s.
I think we started
fishing around. And we've gone every year since then. I would say about 1971 or so. And I have a whole bunch of CDs, but I've lost most of my hard deals.
Right.
Hard copies. Of fish pictures, but
so how did
I got a whole bunch for you anyway?
Great. Well, how did that start? Did that come about from sort of working together again around the Intel.
It did. You know, I think he was getting tired of working as hard as he did, and he's a fisherman. He's a truly great fisherman, and so we started going on these trips. Him and Betty and my wife hits it off with both of them, you know.
Okay.
And we just get along great.
And so you all take an annual fishing trip together?
One or two, yeah.
All right.
Yep.
So in the early days, were you, were these more local? I know that recently you've been going to some pretty exotic fishing spots.
Yeah, we got one lined up now going to someplace in the Indian Ocean that I've never been to. So.
Right.
Yeah. No, we've gone, it's mostly saltwater fishing and, you know, deep sea fishing in the Pacific. Area.
Okay.
Australia and Tahiti and all those places. And, you know, we go every year and just have a great time together. In fact, I got a whole bunch of fish stuffed around here that I wanted to show you, okay?
Okay.
You come over, I'll show them to you.
Sounds good.
Gordon was with me when I caught them all, okay?
I wanted to ask you about one of the questions I had written down to ask you was, you know, what kind of a fisherman is Gordon? I mean, there must be different styles. There's certainly different skill levels. I was wondering if you could talk about him as a fisherman.
Absolutely, it's just like in chemistry and semiconductors. He's a perfectionist at it, you know.
Huh.
When I've been with him, I haven't tied a knot in the last 25 years, you know, because I let him do it.
I see.
He's so good at it, you know. He is really a perfectionist. He really knows what he's doing.
And that's just...
So he's got his own boat over in Hamlin Bay, and we go out there occasionally, but he is a truly professional fisherman.
And that's...
Professional deep-sea fisherman, and fly fisherman, too.
And is that both technique and experience, and also just a knowledge about sort of the fish, you know, their behavior and things like that?
Well, you know, he reads up on all that stuff. He
okay.
doesn't watch TV and stuff, and he reads up on it, and he just knows all about it. And, you know, being a boy from South Dakota, I never knew much about deep sea fishing until it started going with him, you know?
Right.
But he reads up on it, he understands everything about it. He's a perfectionist at chemistry and fishing, you know, and hunting.
Have you guys gone hunting together?
Yeah, in fact, I had a picture here of him. We were wild boar hunting, you know. He's mainly a bird shooter, but I do more big game hunting than he does. But
okay. Well, something that I was thinking about both with both the fishing and the hunting, it seems to me that a big part of that game is patience. Do you think that's true? And does that say something about his personality, you think?
I do. He's a patient guy, you know.
Right.
Very talented fisherman, though, I'll tell you. I've never met anyone better.
Oh, really?
Never.
And,
we've been all over to Tasmania, Australia, and all these places, and, you know. Just have had some great times. Most of the time, just him and me on a fishing boat with the captain, you know.
Right. And then, I'm sorry, what was your wife's name?
Charlene.
Charlene. Then do Betty and Charlene socialize while you guys are out on the boat?
Well, we used to go fishing all the time.
The four of you?
The four of us.
Uh-huh.
And, but Betty and Charlene are getting so that that's not kind of there. You know, this is actually kind of tough workout on those boats, you know?
Sure.
And, Betty especially is getting so she doesn't want to do it anymore.
Right. To spend the hours out on the boat.
Yeah, because it's not, I mean, she has this beautiful place to stay in Hawaii, and she built like a brand new place there, too.
Right.
But, it's hard work.
Right.
You know, this deep-sea fishing with all the banging and the waves and all that stuff, it's hard work, and Gordon's in fantastic shape, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
we go golfing a couple times a year, too.
So I guess it's been, well, it's been over 30 years now that you've been doing
fishing, yeah.
Doing this with
35
him.
35 years, yep.
And, you know, certainly over that time, you know, his company sure changed over that period of time. And so sort of his profile in the semiconductor and electronics world certainly.
Yeah, but he hasn't, as far as I can tell, he hasn't changed since I met him in 57, you know.
That's exactly the question I was going to ask.
No, he hasn't changed as far as I'm concerned. He's still one of the nicest guys in the world, you know, and it's just a lot of fun to be with.
Do you think that it strikes me that my impression is that the same would hold true for Betty Moore as well?
Absolutely. She's the same as she always was, too. I mean, she doesn't take any crap from me, I'll tell you. In fact, we at this lab where I gave all those pictures out, and they had something up in San Francisco for Gordon. They had this guy, some movie star up there that introduced him, and what the hell's he? He's a real famous guy.
Oh, is this maybe Harrison Ford?
Yeah, Harrison Ford.
Right.
Well, she is all upset with Harrison Ford now when we were over there last spring or something, and because he dumped his wife. And she likes his wife. And she doesn't like anybody that dumps their wives.
Right.
And I said, Betty, are you telling me if I dump Charlene's ass, you're not going to talk to me anymore? She says, if you dump her, I'm going to have you killed. You know? So, but she doesn't take any crap from anybody. A lot of fun to be with.
Well, I was wondering if you could, if you'd be willing to give a sampling of some of, your most notable, adventures from these trips. There's gotta have been, I'd imagine, with that many deep-sea fishing trips, there must have been, an eyebrow-raising experience or two.
Yeah, we went to a place called Bathurst Island, and, up north of Australia.
Uh-huh.
You have to take an airplane and fly for an hour and a half, and then you get on the boat and go for 5 hours, and you go to this island, and there's nobody there at all. I mean, this is really the end of the world. And I want to tell you, it's 85 degrees, day, night, rain, salt water, everything's 85 degrees. You never get a chance to be cool, you know. And we went there and went fishing in Bathurst Island. That was probably one of out in the ocean because you couldn't go in the water because they have these sea crocodiles and these big sharks and these terrible little things called sea urchins or something.
Right.
And I mean, it was a tough week of fishing. But Gordon says, and I say too, it was really one of our fun times. I mean, but the weather was so miserable. You only get 2 quarts of water a day, and you know.
So were you mostly on the boat the whole time then, or?
No, we were inshore, but our boat was parked at this big river, and I had about a 20-foot tide come in, and the boat would be way down below, and there, I mean, the wildlife, never saw another person, saw a couple of airplanes flying over way away, you know.
Right.
For a week.
Wow.
Not one person there, and my wife, we both had our boats, and, little boats, and I remember we were out. My wife and I were out fishing. We were fly fishing for barramundi, which is an Australian fish.
And okay.
You look down below the boat, and here is this hammerhead shark whose hammers are wider than our boat.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it was really... this was a strange thing. I think Gordon would probably admit that it was one of the most interesting. Betty was sick a lot of the time, but it was one of the most interesting times. I mean, this is back in the real wilderness,
right.
I'll tell you. Hatteras Island.
And are there any other, do you have any other favorite fishing stories? I mean, there just must be so many.
Well, I've got some fish here, mounted fish that Gordon was with me when I caught them all, and I've got so many fish stories you wouldn't believe, you know.
Well, maybe we can save that to when we're actually looking at the victims.
Yeah.
Great.
And don't forget, I've got a CD of a whole bunch of just the last few years. You know, one of the people we used to go fishing with was Gordon's brother, Fran.
Oh.
And he, another one of the nice guys in the world. He's dead now, but...
Was he the brother who worked the ranch in Pescadero?
No, that was Walt.
Okay, that was Walt.
And he lost both those brothers in about the, you know, in the same short period of time, you know.
Right. And Francis had
he had a distribution company of some sort.
Right, and I want to say, like, automotive parts or...
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah. What was,
He was a great guy.
Was he very much like Gordon is, or were they very different?
No, I think they were quite different. They were great. You know, Fran used to come out here pressing on all the time, and they just had a different lifestyle, you know.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I think... I thought I could close with one other sort of question today, which would be to ask you about, well, two questions. One thing that not a lot of people have talked about, but that I definitely get a sense of is Gordon's sense of humor. I mean, he really strikes me as a person who has a very kind of dry, but a very well-developed sense of humor. What's your sense about that?
Well, I think that him and I just really enjoy a good chuckle all the time, you know?
Right.
And with me, he doesn't have to worry about being politically incorrect or anything, and And a lot of laughs.
And a lot of history there, so
a lot of laughs. So we were always joking about stuff, and he can't do that with a lot of the people he's with, you know.
Right.
And he doesn't worry about me, and we just have a lot of fun together. And you know, he's one of the world's great cooks. You ever go to Hawaii there and get to have that yellowfin tuna that he cooks on the barbecue, boy?
No, I'll try.
Gotta request it anyway.
I'll have to angle for that. That sounds very nice.
He is a great cook. But don't let me underestimate his ability as a fisherman, because he's superbly knowledgeable about everything in fishing. And just a lot of fun to be with.
And I guess the last question that I would have for the conversation right now, and when we meet again, we can return and go deeper into some of these things that we've talked about. But if you were given the challenge of naming what you thought were Gordon's most important personality traits or values, how would you try to answer that question?
Oh, God. Well, he's a terribly honest guy. He's smart and...
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, I can see why they don't, because he's not in the business of humorous business. And,
well, they're
kind of,
yeah.
You know, one thing I didn't mention is that he is really all the natural stuff, the birds, the plants, the animals that we see on these trips. I mean, he's really knowledgeable about them, and the fish, especially the fish. And him and I got fish. We go out in a little rowboat out there and catch fish that nobody's ever been able to identify, you know?
Wow.
And he's really interested in that stuff. So I think probably his, how would I say it,
right.
Especially the natural life, natural stuff. And when he finds out something he doesn't know about, by God, next time you talk to him, he's looked it up somewhere, you know?
Well, that's, I mean, I think that's his interest in you know, conservation, the stuff that he does with that, the foundation. I mean, I think that's seems to me to be rooted in that sort of genuine fascination with biology or the natural world.
Yeah. I don't know how that deals with chemistry, but...
That's just, you know, fascination with nature, I guess, in a different form or something.
Yeah, it is fascination with, I mean, him and I will, we'll walk 4 hours to go see this bird that nobody has seen for a long time, you know, and things like that. So,
right,
he's really up on stuff like that, you know.
Right. Well, maybe what I can do is, I think maybe I'll switch off this recording machine right now, and then maybe we can